Our second case is 2020-1583, the State of Ohio versus Guy Billy Lee Scott. For the appellant, Mr. Castor.
Chief Justice O'Connor, and may it please the court. In Ohio and around the nation, DNA has proven itself to be an invaluable tool in correcting wrongful convictions. And 8 years ago in State versus Noling, this court said that one important component of that tool is the evidence stored in the combined index DNA system, or the database commonly known as CODIS. The decision of the court below, however, would require trial courts to blind themselves to that important evidence, despite the General Assembly's direction that in adjudicating a petition for post-conviction DNA testing, courts should consider all of the available admissible evidence. Your Honors, this case has its genesis in 1990, when Lisa Buckley was raped and murdered sometime during a large outdoor party near New Paris, Ohio. No physical evidence connected defendant Mr. Scott to the crime, and the partygoers indeed included two people, including an abusive ex-boyfriend of the victim, of whom Ms. Buckley was deathly afraid and who she predicted would one day be responsible for her death. Nonetheless, 2 years later, Mr. Scott was convicted of the crimes. In the proceedings below, Mr. Scott sought DNA testing of two key pieces of evidence from the crime, a post-mortem rape kit and scrapings from beneath the fingernails of the victim. The Preble County prosecutor opposed post-conviction testing partially on the basis that the victim may have had consensual sex with a partner at some time prior to testing. But in this case and in others, using the evidence stored in the CODIS database to identify the source of any DNA recovered during the testing process would conclusively establish the identity of the true perpetrator.
Why would that be conclusive, particularly if there was consensual sexual intercourse prior to her death?
Well, because it's important to remember that in the facts of this case, and all of these analyses in post-conviction DNA testing will necessarily be fact-bound, of course, Your Honor, but under the facts of this case, we have people at the party for whom there is no evidence that the victim would have had consensual sex prior to it. There are people at the party at the scene of the crime who had motive, who had opportunity, and whose DNA would not be explained by any lawful activity.
What about prior to the party?
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
What about prior to the party?
Well, prior to the party, yes, there was a boyfriend separate, and to be clear, under the facts of this case, separate from the abusive ex-boyfriend, there was an intimate partner at the time. But CODIS testing would establish, are we talking, because the two people at the party are felons in the CODIS database, as was demonstrated to the court below.
So why CODIS and not against his own?
I'm sorry, against whose own, Your Honor?
You say that he only wants to test it against CODIS.
Well, I'm sorry if I misspoke, Your Honor. Of course, we're looking at two things in this case, Your Honor. We're looking at, and this is what the statute speaks of. The statute speaks of an exclusion result and the results of the testing, Your Honor. So, of course, we're looking at the impact of an exclusion result. So, yes, under the statute, there's no question but that a swab from Mr. Scott would be taken. It's presumably already been taken on his way into the Department of Corrections. But a swab would be taken, a buccal swab, and the DNA would be compared to Mr. Scott. So what we're talking about, Your Honor, is an exclusion result coupled with all of the available admissible evidence. And that's the definition that the General Assembly set forth in defining outcome determinative. When the General Assembly defined outcome determinative, and the phrase outcome determinative is used three different times in the acceptance criteria for determining whether an applicant is entitled to post-conviction DNA testing, the General Assembly said, had the results of the DNA testing been presented at trial and found relevant and admissible, then when analyzed in the context of all available admissible evidence, there's a strong probability no reasonable fact finder would have found the convicted person guilty of the offense.
So if there is a test, the court permits it, and there's testing, and the DNA comes back, and none of it matches Mr. Scott, then, of course, your argument is that that is exclusionary. That excludes him.
That would be an exclusion. If it matched someone other than Mr. Scott, that would be an exclusion.
Then do you go to the next step of comparing the sample through putting it through CODIS?
Well, and that yes, you go to the next step, but to get there, you have to consider what the realm, or the trial court has to consider what the realm of available admissible evidence is. And the Eighth District talked about precisely this question in the State versus Ayers decision, which I know Your Honor is familiar with. And in State versus Ayers, the Eighth District discussed the realm of cases which an exclusion alone might not be enough to be completely exonerative under the statute. The Eighth District pointed to other cases that were similar to that and said, look, there are cases when a court may have to consider things beyond the exclusion result. And indeed, the General Assembly, in its clear language, intended that a trial court would consider things beyond the exclusion result, because the General Assembly didn't say the exclusion result standing alone. The General Assembly didn't say the exclusion result and then was silent otherwise. The General Assembly talked about an exclusion result, but then it talked about two other things. It talked about test results, which is a phrase broader than exclusion result, and it talked about all available admissible evidence. In that context, then, the General Assembly also gave an important grant of power to trial courts in the DNA testing process. The General Assembly gave trial courts the authority to order uploads of any profiles developed in the DNA testing process to CODIS. Unless trial courts are able to consider the possibility that a CODIS hit would come back to someone other than the defendant, then that grant of power is superfluous. If the General Assembly intended simply that the trial court would consider an exclusion result and nothing else, there's absolutely no reason for the General Assembly to grant that CODIS upload authority to the trial courts. Because if an exclusion result on its own is enough, then proceedings then move, after testing is complete, to post-conviction relief, which is under a different set of statutes. The standard, though, is to outcome determinative is the same. The defendant in that case would say, hey, exclusion result, I'm innocent, we're done. And then the prosecutor may want to go in a separate proceeding and subject the evidence to DNA testing. And I point out for the court, Your Honors, that if this crime, which occurred back in 1990, occurred today, there'd be almost no question that the evidence that's being sought for testing would be subjected to DNA testing today.
Mr. Votel, over on your right.
Yes, I'm Mr. Castor. I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Sorry, Mr. Castor. I'm sorry. The trial transcript is not in the record. Do we need it to decide this case?
Well, Your Honor, two issues, Your Honor. First of all, the courts below clearly considered the trial transcript in its case. And in fact, in one subsection of the DNA statute, and I don't have it, the trial court is specifically directed to consider the trial transcript as part of its...
But it's not in our record of this case. Do we need it?
No, Your Honor. This court doesn't need it for the proposition of law in this case, because the relief that we're asking for from this court is we would not anticipate that based on the proceedings in the court below, this court would order DNA testing. We believe that this court would order a remand for the trial court and the Court of Appeals to consider the case under the properly articulated standard. And remember, in this case, the 12th District at paragraphs 18 and 19 of its decision said that a trial court is without the authority to consider the impact of a CODIS hit in its determination of whether testing would be outcome determinative.
Was the trial court that denied this request, was it the same judge who presided over the original trial?
It was not, Your Honor, no.
So he made his determination, or he or she made their determination by reviewing transcripts about the strength of the other evidence, the other circumstantial evidence?
That's correct, Your Honor. When the trial court made its decision, and again the 12th District, it's clear that both the trial court and the 12th District had the transcript in front of it. And I apologize that that transcript was not transmitted from the 12th District to this court. But the decision is clear, replete with transcript citations, that the trial court considered the trial record in this case. Both parties cited extensively to the trial transcript in this case.
So you're saying we don't need to order it? We could order it, but you're saying we don't need to?
Well, there are two issues, Your Honor.
You just said it was unfortunate, so I'm trying to get an answer. Well,
I'm sorry, Justice Brenner. Yes, this court certainly could order the transcript and should order the transcript to see, again, that I'm not making this up. There is no physical evidence that links Mr. Scott to this case.
There wasn't a DNA testing at the time. Correct?
There was no DNA testing.
Right, so when you say there's no physical evidence, you don't know whether your client's DNA will be discovered here.
No, Your Honor, and that's precisely why the General Assembly began the enactment of the statutes. Every justice on this court is well aware that there have been cases where DNA testing has been sought and obtained, and the applicant has been linked further to the crime.
Okay, so apparently the appellate court does not think the DNA testing would be outcome determinative here.
That's correct, Your Honor.
All right, and the trial court, the same opinion based on the statute.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Okay. Am I mistaken when I said when I understand that part of the rationale is there's so much other evidence that points to your client's guilt that DNA is unnecessary?
Yes, Your Honor, with a big except to that, yes, Your Honor. That is what the 12th District and the trial court found. But the 12th District and the trial court explicitly held that it would not consider the possibility of a CODIS hit. Given the statute, given that the statute says that outcome determinativeness is based on a strong probability of a reasonable fact finder would do, what the 12th District and what this court should do is put itself in the position of a juror in the case and determine the outcome determinative. What would
have... So if they are going to, in their limited view here, if they would do a DNA testing, it would be only to match only your client's DNA. They wouldn't then take presumably if it doesn't match, they wouldn't then take that sample, the court's saying, we would not take the sample and explore it against the larger pool of DNA results.
The 12th District said that in considering whether testing should be granted, it would not consider the possibility of that happening. That's correct, Your Honor.
Okay. But what if we look at the statute, 2953.71U, which acknowledges that a DNA test is not definitive until it, quote, clearly establishes that biological material from the perpetrator was found and also clearly establishes whether or not that biological material is that of the eligible offender. It seems like you would have to run it through the entire CODIS system, and if it obtained a hit on something that wasn't identifiable with your client, then, I mean, isn't it fair to say that there could be the inference from this statute that it may show that there's another perpetrator other than your client, which then would affect what the jury had in front of it and the conclusions the jury reached?
If I understand the question correctly, Your Honor, and I think I do, I believe the answer is yes, and this is an important point, that given the statutory definition of outcome determinative, the trial court should put itself in the position of a reasonable, properly instructed juror. And in this case, the trial court and the Court of Appeals didn't do that, at least not with respect to the universe of available admissible evidence. And that's the standard that was enunciated by the General Assembly.
Is that only if there isn't a DNA hit on your client?
I'm sorry?
Is that going to the next step, comparing DNA in the CODIS database? Is that only if there is no hit with your client?
If it hit to Mr. Scott and there were no other sources of DNA...
Well, but before we get to the second step, does it have to exclude him in the first step? Or are you saying even if he's excluded, or even if it's a hit on him, we still go to the second step to compare it to the universe in CODIS?
I understand the question, Your Honor. And under 295374E, the grant of authority to order CODIS uploads, that authority is not conditioned on an exclusion result. Obviously, a trial court would say, in considering whether testing would be outcome determinative, that it should only be considered outcome determinative if there was an exclusion result coupled with a CODIS hit and other available admissible evidence. And that's what the 8th District spoke of. And in fact, that's what the Nolan Court considered in the 2013 Nolan decision. This court considered, when it was looking at whether a prior test was definitive, this court said that the ability to upload to CODIS is an important component of the DNA testing analysis process.
Take you right back to Justice Stewart's first original question. Let's just say it's true. You test his DNA, you put it through CODIS, he's excluded, and you get a hit. You still have the issue of consensual sex, which then doesn't make it outcome determinative.
Chief Justice, I think my time has expired. May I answer the question?
Yes.
Thank you, Your Honor. Your Honor, there are two responses to that. One is that, first of all, the trial court never considered it under the proper standard, never considered that possibility, so this case should be remanded for the trial court to consider it under the proper standard. But secondly, Your Honor, the answer is that under the specific facts of this case, there is perhaps a person with whom consensual sex was had, but there are other people at the party of whom the victim was deathly afraid, who there's no evidence there would have been consensual sex with. There's no evidence that there would be any reason for skin cells to be deposited under the victim's fingernails. And that's why we test those places. And that's why police test those places routinely in cases today where DNA testing was available, where it wasn't widely available back in 1990.
Counsel, do you know if the DNA samples are still in existence?
We believe they are. It's never been represented in the court below that they are not available for testing, Your Honor.
All right, thank you. Your time's up.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Vogel.
Thank you, Your Honor. My name is Philip Bogdanoff. I represent the state of Ohio.
Sorry, I didn't recognize you, Phil.
Thank you. The Chief Justice used to be my boss many, 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 many years ago.
Which doesn't influence my decision whatsoever.
But as the Chief Justice knows, prosecutors have an ethical duty not only to convict, but also to do justice. And prosecutors across the country are forming victim integrity units. And instead of trying to put people in jail, they are trying to get people out of prison, because we recognize that we do not always convict guilty individuals.
Then, counsel, what would be the harm in allowing this DNA testing to go forward?
Because there is a screening process. The conviction integrity units have screening processes because you cannot do DNA testing for the hundreds of thousands of people who are in prison who are claiming to be innocent. There must be a screening process.
Is there really that many people claiming that they're innocent?
Yes,
hundreds of thousands of people? Do you have a source for that?
I just read on the internet the other day, the Innocence Project gets 3,000 claims, I think, either a month or a year. So there are a lot of
they don't take those claims.
They don't, exactly. And the reason they don't take them all is because they have a screening process. And the screening process looks at which cases is the evidence so weak that a DNA result would be outcome determinative. Prosecutors are doing this.
But let's go to Mr. Scott's case. So if DNA were allowed in this case, and it excluded him, you're saying that biological evidence that would exclude the defendant who was convicted of these crimes would not be outcome determinative?
Correct, Your Honor. That was the finding of the trial court. The trial court, and you can read the court's opinion, looks at all of the overwhelming evidence in this case, and you have the defendant.
But when you say overwhelming evidence, you have to put yourself in the case of a reasonable juror. And you know jurors love DNA evidence. And so with all the evidence against Mr. Scott, if the juror heard, well, but the fingernail scrapings didn't match Mr. Scott, and semen didn't match Mr. Scott, and hair fibers didn't match Mr. Scott, You don't think the jury might have had reasonable doubt?
No, Your Honor, and I think the trial judge is in the best position to make that determination, did an excellent job in their findings indicating that these were all friends together. When you look at...
But counsel, excuse me,
sure.
Didn't he make the trial court judge, as I heard from your friend on the other side, he or she made that determination by reviewing transcript testimony. They weren't even the trial court judge. So how can they assess the credibility of people? For instance, I know there were people that said that they heard Mr. Scott admit to the crime, okay? So that's either true that they heard that or they didn't. They could have lied, right?
That is correct, Your Honor. But you have to understand now, the jury believed those individuals.
Okay, I understand.
The finality of judgment. That person didn't found guilty.
But, counsel, that happened in State versus Ayers, too. And when David Ayers was convicted, he was convicted because someone allegedly, he confessed the crime to someone.
I understand. This person confessed the crime approximately three or four different times to three or four different individuals, plus the fact he was at the scene, somebody observed him having sex with the victim.
So in that instance, he's likely not to get any exclusion result.
I understand that, Your Honor, but you have to follow the statute. The statute provides a screening process, and there's three steps to the statute. Number one step is you have to be a person who qualifies. If you pled guilty or pled no contest or you're no longer in prison, you don't qualify at all. The second step is when you
follow... Is there any question that Mr. Scott is eligible?
He is eligible, okay. No question. The second step... is where do you have the application? And there are two key terms there. You have an exclusion result, and you have outcome determinative. And that is where we have the issue before the court. Because the statute goes to great detail to explain what an exclusion result is. They said, if you take that DNA and you presume, it's a presumption, it does not match the defendant, then you look at all the other evidence that was admitted at trial and make a determination whether or not a reasonable jury, after looking at the DNA testing, finding it did not match the defendant, would they have found the defendant guilty or not guilty?
All right, counsel, hypothetical. Let's say that the DNA testing goes forward. It excludes the defendant, but it has a hit on the alternative suspect they've alluded to, the ex-boyfriend who she was deathly afraid of. That would totally undermine the theory of guilt that was used before the jury to convict him, correct? Wouldn't that be outcome determinative?
It would be outcome determinative, but you have to get past the application process. He did not get past the application process because the trier of fact and the Court of Appeals found that the evidence was so overwhelming.
So you're saying even if the DNA, the trial court is theoretically saying, even if I had this DNA evidence, the reviewing trial court, not the original trial court, even if this evidence was present that he was excluded, there's so much other damning evidence here that a jury would unquestionably convict him in the face of an exclusionary DNA test.
Exactly, Your Honor. And what the defendant wants to do now is to change this standard to indicate not only is there an exclusion result, but we're going to assume and presume there is a CODIS match at the application stage. That is not in the legislation. And that is why...
Do you think that if there was an exclusion, let's go back to the investigatory stages of this crime. Had there been, fast forward, as the crime is 2021, so the technology is present-day DNA technology. They do a DNA analysis, and this client, Mr. Scott, is excluded. All right. Would he even be charged at this point based on the sophisticated DNA testing that law enforcement uses?
Yes, Your Honor.
And he would be charged because of the other evidence?
Correct, Your Honor. And also you have to realize this body had been in the water for a long time. We don't know if that DNA
is actually even in existence at that point in time. So I understand that DNA is always thought of as 100% determinative, but you have to realize this body was in the water for a long time.
I understand all the vagaries that may be attached to the DNA testing, and the quality of the testing is not the question here. It's whether or not DNA testing can be done. But the next step, now again, we're at the investigatory stage, the next step would be that or maybe even the first step, law enforcement would run it through CODIS, would they not, the DNA?
Present day today, I do not know that for a fact. If it were today, what they would do with the DNA, assuming they found a DNA sample.
Or compare it to swabs of other alleged suspects or people of interest.
I guess that would be a possibility, Your Honor. They would.
So why wouldn't we be able to look at what the code calls a definitive DNA test and look at language that says it clearly establishes whether or not the biological material is that of the eligible offender? Why couldn't we include the potential that it could identify a different perpetrator? Because that fits within, it's subsumed by that description, whether or not the biological material is that. Why can't we do that?
Because the legislation indicates very strictly what the courts are to consider. I believe there is a remedy here. If you feel very strongly about that, then you need to send a message to the legislature to rewrite the screening process. This court has indicated on numerous occasions it is not here to write legislation, it's to interpret what the legislature has done. And what the legislature has done is to indicate that at the application stage, you only look at an exclusion result.
Can we find that the trial court's reasoning and the Court of Appeals' affirmance of that reasoning is incorrect for the application process?
No, Your Honor, because the courts followed the law. They followed what the legislature told you to do.
When you say followed the law, you're saying the trial court here said, with all the other evidence against Mr. Scott, if there's DNA testing and it shows that fingernail scrapings were not hit to Mr. Scott, semen wasn't Mr. Scott, hair fibers isn't Mr. Scott, all biological evidence present on the victim, none of it matched Mr. Scott. The trial court still says, despite that, this jury would have still found him guilty beyond a reasonable doubt. And now, I'm not saying that they couldn't find any DNA evidence, but that they found some and none of it matched the defendant.
That's the presumption, Your Honor. That is a presumption set forth by the legislature.
And we can't say that defies logic.
Your Honor, that's not the reason you took the case. The reason you took the case, and I think somebody made the point at the earlier case, you're here to set forth case law for the entire state of Ohio. And the reason you took this case was to determine whether or not you are going to have a presumption that there was a CODIS match at the application stage. That's why this case is here. You don't take cases to review facts. You review cases to set the law for Ohio. Right now, you have two districts that have indicated you don't apply the presumption because that's within the statute, and you have two cases that don't do any statutory analysis and say there's a presumption there that there is a CODIS match. So you have to set the law for Ohio, and this law for Ohio as a set.
Which two cases do no analysis on that? Reynolds and Ayers?
Yes, Reynolds and Ayers case. They just throw it out there that there should be a CODIS match. No analysis of the statute whatsoever. And
I beg to differ about Ayers since I wrote it, but...
With all due respect, Judge, I apologize.
But I will say, at least, the Ayers case primarily dealt with whether testing was res judicata.
And with due respect to the court, you did not look at the statute to determine whether or not at the application stage there was a presumption of a CODIS match.
Okay, fair enough.
That's what I'm saying.
Fair enough.
There is no statutory analysis, and that's what I'm indicating to this court. You have to follow the screening process set forth by the legislature.
But counsel, why can't, instead of doing the two-step, which is test my DNA and also test it against all the other DNA that you have in the CODIS, right? That's what he's asking for.
He's asking for a presumption. No, Your Honor, he's asking for a presumption. You are to assume at the trial level that not only is the DNA not the defendant's, but also to presume that that DNA matches a third party. This is all about presumptions. That's all this is about.
No, that these crime scene evidence could match a profile contained in the CODIS database.
You also will see in his brief, he asked for a presumption. That was the argument he set forth in the Court of Appeals. And he also puts he calls it a putative match. That is a presumption. Another word for presumption. He is asking for a presumption. Because anything is possible, Your Honor. That doesn't help him. Anything is possible. An argument, say, okay, it could be a CODIS match. That doesn't help him. What he wants is a presumption of a CODIS match, and that is in his issue. That is why we are here. Not only does he want a presumption that the DNA excludes the defendant, which is in the statute, he wants a presumption of a CODIS match, which is not in the statute. And he did not make that argument that that is included in all available evidence in the trial court. He did not make that in the Court of Appeals. He only makes that argument in this court because the lower court indicated to him there's nothing in the statute that tells us we must presume that the DNA will be a CODIS match. It's not there. So in the Ohio Supreme Court, he comes up with these words, all available evidence. That's where it's at. And that's why you have this case. You have to determine whether or not those three words, all available evidence, authorizes a presumption of a CODIS match. I believe that you must read the statute and apply it as is written. And there's plenty of case laws in my brief that indicate that. You do not put language in a statute. You interpret the language that is there. If they had wanted to have a presumptive CODIS match, they would have defined that term in the definition just like they defined an exclusionary result and outcome determinative. That would be there. They would put a presumptive CODIS match.
If we're to put ourselves in the place of the jury, do we need the transcript?
Your Honor, I think a transcript would be helpful to the court because that's what the judge did. The judge read the transcript and then determined that there was so much overwhelming evidence that even if there were an exclusionary result, that it would not have changed the result at trial. So I think a transcript would be helpful.
How would it be helpful if we can't assess really the credibility of just reading a transcript of someone and saying that sounds credible?
I think you have to interpret like any other case. You have to assume the trier of fact found that the witnesses were credible. Remember, this person was found guilty. That is your scope of review, is the credibility is an issue for the trier of fact.
And there's hundreds and hundreds of people across the United States that the jury found the testimony credible and have since been exonerated.
I don't think it's been hundreds of thousands, Your Honor.
I said hundreds and hundreds.
About hundreds. And you have to realize in those cases, each of those cases started with a screening process. We would not be able to handle if every case where somebody said they were innocent was granted DNA testing. It would throw off the system. It would be too many cases. So we have a screening process. All the state is asking you to do is to follow the screening process set forth by the state legislature. And that screening process indicates you assume that the DNA does not match the defendant. You review the evidence that was admitted at trial, and then you make a determination whether or not a reasonable jury would have found the defendant not guilty.
And that process is reviewable.
Correct, Your Honor.
But at the Court of Appeals level.
That is correct, Your Honor.
But that's not, so the issue here is that process, whether there's anything incorrect based on statutory interpretation of that process.
Exactly, Ron. That's why this case is here. It's statutory interpretation. Is there language in that statute where not only is the trial court to presume that the DNA does not match the defendant, but do we also have a presumption that that DNA evidence would match a third party or
not could match?
Or a CODIS match.
Not could match, but would match?
Would match. Yes, you go from exclude to would match. Would match somebody in the CODIS data space. Now, that comes later on. After the application process, if the court grants the application, then they do send it to CODIS. And that is one of the arguments set forth by the defendant is, wait a minute, we have a CODIS match, but sequencing is important. You've said that in your other cases. And that does not come until after the application is granted. It has nothing to do with the application process. So I think when you review the statute, you will find that the trial court properly applied the statute, found the defendant was not eligible. The Court of Appeals properly applied the statute. And the issue is that is before you, whether or not you should presume a CODIS match, is not in the legislative language, and therefore the trial court and the Court of Appeals findings should be affirmed. Does the court have any further questions?
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. Counsel, you've used your time. You may take a minute. Would you address the position that there's a presumption, that you're asking for this presumption?
First of all, Your Honor, we never phrased it in terms of a presumption, Your Honor. What we said is that the court should consider in adjudicating the application the possibility, because that's the only way for the court to consider all of the available admissible evidence.
So if we adopt that position, doesn't that mean that in virtually any case that you'd be entitled to DNA testing? Because if there's a match, if there's with someone on the CODIS database, then that could be outcome determinative.
Certainly not, Your Honor, no. Because, and the 8th District addressed that point specifically in the Ayers decision, and the 8th District said, when you consider the possibility of a CODIS hit, when you consider all of that available admissible evidence, you still have to make the determination that in that particular instance, it would be relevant. Here, it is, because we're talking about fingernails.
If there's biological material, say under someone's fingernails, isn't almost always relevant if it matches up with someone else than the person who's been charged with the crime?
What the court said here is particularly important, though, or what Your Honor said here is particularly important, which is under the fingernails. This is a case where very specific DNA testing is being requested. There's a whole universe of cases where there isn't a postmortem rape kit, where there isn't fingernail scrapings, where an applicant is looking for evidence to be tested from some remote part of the crime scene, and that's the universe of cases, Your Honor, that you're looking for, that a trial court would have to make a finding that such a match would be relevant. Here,
in all those types of cases, essentially, where there's fingernails or a rape kit or in all those cases, then testing would be required under the statute.
You also have the affidavit from Dr.
Counsel,
Wright.
Excuse me. Let him answer Justice DeWine's question.
In cases such as this one, where we're talking about postmortem rape kits and fingernail scrapings, and given the facts of this case and the universe of people who had motive and opportunity to commit crimes.
Do you need the last two? Under your test, any case where you had a rape kit or, say, fingernail scrapings, there's a potential it could match someone else, and that would be outcome determinative, right? Well,
but the question is would it be? One can certainly imagine a situation where a victim was married to someone known to be in the CODIS database, and perhaps in that situation it wouldn't be, or where there's no evidence that there were people who were in the CODIS.
But it could match someone else in the CODIS database, right? So that would still require testing under your theory.
Under our theory, Your Honor, it would require the trial court to make a determination as to whether that would be relevant and as to whether that would have a reasonable fact finder, that is a juror, find a different result. In this case, the trial court didn't make that determination. That's what we're asking this court to do, to send this back to the trial court for a determination under the properly articulated standard, which includes all of the available admissible evidence, which includes the evidence in the CODIS database, which the General Assembly directed trial courts to have access to.
But how do you respond to your friend on the other side when he said, this question presented to us is completely different from what was presented below? Reading the trial court order and those materials, you didn't ask or they didn't ask for this presumption, that you start with the presumption that or probability you'd have a CODIS hit. That wasn't what was in front of the appellate court, because it was just the trial court erred in finding the test would not be outcome determinative. So how do we even reach this question?
Well, Your Honor, I disagree respectfully with my friend's reading of the record. We asked throughout the proceedings that the trial court order an upload to CODIS. We argued throughout the proceedings that an upload to CODIS coupled with a hit to particularly one of the known alternate suspects in this case, who had been identified during the time of the investigation as the possible perpetrators, that a match to those people would be outcome determinative. We argued that to the 12th District as well, as that's why paragraphs 18 and 19 exist in the 12th District's decision, saying that the trial court didn't have the authority to consider the possibility of a CODIS hit. That's what's in the 12th District's decision, and it's not out of the blue, Your Honor. It's in response to arguments that we were making in the courts below. Your Honors, there is always evidence on the prosecution side of the ledger in a post-conviction case. But this court and the General Assembly have embraced and adopted the power and science of DNA to resolve wrongful convictions. This court should not step away from that today. It should adopt the grant of authority given by the General Assembly and the direction of the General Assembly to consider all available admissible evidence.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. We'll take the matter under advisement. You'll be notified of our decision. Marshall, will you call a recess?
All rise.